Dancing in the Liminal, a global border-crossing inquiry into art, activism, spirituality, and leadership for the 21st century. I'm your dialogue hostess, Vanessa Fisher, and I'm here with my guest, Gretchen Steidel-Wallace. Gretchen is the founder and president of Global Grassroots, an international organization working at the intersection of personal and societal transformation to catalyze grassroots change agents working for women's rights and well-being in post-conflict regions. In 2007, Gretchen was honored by World Business Magazine and Shell as one of the top international 35 women under 35. Gretchen is also the producer of the documentary film The Devil Came on Horseback, which was nominated for 3 Emmy Awards in 2009. And in 2010, Gretchen was chosen with her husband as CNN Heroes working in Haiti after the earthquake. She was also chosen as one of the 7 Remarkable Women of the World by New Hampshire Magazine. I came across Gretchen's work about a month ago, and I was really impacted by the social change initiatives Gretchen was engaging in post-war Africa. Gretchen brings a really unique and holistic approach to international development that supports sustainable change initiatives in some of the most marginalized communities in the world, so I was really inspired to have her on my dialogue series. So, Gretchen, it's with great pleasure that I welcome you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So you have a really fascinating background and bio, and I'd just love to start. I think my audience would be really interested just to hear a bit about your history and journey and how your passion brought you to the work you're doing today and how it's evolved over time.
Sure, thank you. You know, I think my passion and my path that led me to working internationally, especially with women, started when I was really little. I'm a Navy brat. I grew up moving around the world. And when I was 9 and 10, I lived overseas in the Philippines. And I don't know if it was something that I signed up for, or something my parents, who were frequently apt to throw me into new experiences, were responsible for doing so. But I, at one point, found myself in an exchange program living with a young Filipino girl who spoke no English, and I spoke no Tagalog. And I was assigned to live with her and her family in their small Nipa hut in the middle of this rural fishing village for a week. And it was one of the most extraordinary experiences that I've ever had. I still look back on today. I was terrified. I was really shy those days. And I was as polite as I could be about experiencing and accepting anything that was offered to me without complaint. But it was an extremely terrifying experience as I began this journey into a new world. I went to school with her, where, you know, we sat without access to books, and a woman, their teacher, would write on a blackboard, which was really just a piece of wood painted with black paint. And in the evenings, we would play with seashells and sticks and coconuts. And suddenly, over the course of that week, I relaxed into this extraordinary experience of joy and connection with a village that was so different from my own life. And yet I found some of the most important life lessons there, that happiness didn't really depend on material well-being. And there was such a sense of community that I didn't have living in a sort of a duplex on a military base. And the week after that experience, the young girl came to live with me. And I was really excited about showing her my room and my stuff and having her experience my life, thinking she would marvel at, even though in American standards was a pretty modest living situation, it would be luxurious for her. And it turned out that she hated it. And she was so homesick. And she was equally terrified by the things that she was experiencing. Hmm. And for me, I suddenly stepped back and realized as well that I could not assume to know what someone else wanted or how they wanted their lives to transform, you know, what their desires in life were. And these lessons that I learned in that experience have evolved over time, but have deeply influenced the way that I approach the world in recognizing that I have a place in it. There's something that I can contribute that's defined by my unique experience, but that's the same for everyone too. And I can't necessarily assume that I know what's best or that I am there to fix things, but there's a collaborative possibility where this coming together invites new inspiration and perspectives and new possibilities. That began my quest for what then is my purpose? What is it that I can do in the world? And I had two very distinct paths that I was involved with that eventually merged to become what Global Grassroots, my organization, is today. And the first is sort of the world of business and social entrepreneurship. I took a pretty traditional path initially out of school and became an investment banker and went to business school and expected to be involved in the world of international business and found myself much more fascinated with the social and economic and social and environmental impact of the work that I was doing and eventually transitioned into the realm of social entrepreneurship, which is just like the way business entrepreneurs are innovative in creating new products and services, social entrepreneurs are, with innovation, solving systemic social issues like health issues or education or violence. And I loved new ideas and I love the innovation happening and just found myself passionately drawn to being involved with change agents, especially those in the most disadvantaged parts of the world. At the same time, having been incredibly stressed out by my work in the business world, I remember one day I actually drove off the road into a ditch because I was thinking too much about all the things I had to do. I had met at one point in my life this woman who had this sense of presence. You know, when you meet someone and they're so there with you that you feel like you're the only person in the universe talking to them. And she had such joy and connection and wisdom about her. I wanted whatever it was that, you know, I thought it was like some vitamin supplement. I was like, what are you taking? I want that. And she said, well, I'm an integrative breathwork practitioner. And
this was your first kind of inroad into the psycho-spiritual practices, or were you familiar with that before?
Well, I was seeking, but I didn't know where to find it. You know, I'd go to Whole Foods and walk around the aisles buying healthy cookbooks and incense and thinking, you know, this is going to take me where I need to go. And I tried meditation and, you know, I felt like I was sort of trying on different spiritual clothes. So I tried this course with breath work. And what I found there that I was seeking elsewhere was myself. I found that there's a path to connect with your essential unconditional self. And that is where wisdom and clarity and connection and joy and love and truth and all the things I was seeking outside of myself, that's where that resides. And it was such an extraordinary awakening for me that I continued with this community now over 10 years now and became a breathwork practitioner myself, mostly because it was just a modality, and there's so many, but a modality that for me had been so transformative that I wanted to be able to be a practitioner of that practice and to be supportive of others.
It's fascinating because you went into this as your kind of own practice, but you ended up really bringing that into your work in a very powerful way.
Yes. What I discovered as I was developing Global Grassroots and developing my skills as a breathworker was that there were so many people in the world of humanitarian aid work, disaster relief, activism, that were burnt out, they were angry, they were competitive, they were giving up because they were disillusioned, or they were so attached to their own agenda that they were just not even in tune with the needs of the people they were serving. And it just occurred to me that if we're not taking care of ourselves, if we're not investing first in our own self-awareness, how can we really understand what's needed to serve others? Change is hard. If you're trying to create change in the world and you're trying to change other people or get other people to change, if you're not starting from a premise of understanding change in yourself, then you can't have the compassion, the empathy, the willingness to work at the roots of an issue. You're just looking at trying to force or incentivize people to make shifts that may not be sustainable or really truly transformative. So it all starts from within.
You can end up projecting quite a lot as well if you haven't really cleared your own.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I just came to really fully believe that personal transformation and social transformation have to go hand in hand. You can't separate them in order to advance a more conscious society and move us in the direction that is our highest possibility. So that began to lead me to experiment with bringing different mindfulness techniques and mind-body healing techniques into the work that I was doing around the world.
And you founded Global Grassroots in 2004.
I did.
And I'm curious, do you want to just share a bit about how, I mean, I know you were kind of attracted to Africa before that, and you had done your documentary film, and that had sort of led to your interest in that region. Is that right?
That's correct. You know, most of my background prior to starting Global Grassroots was actually in Asia, but I had this curiosity about why social change was just not spreading. You know, it seemed to me there were some really phenomenal ideas out there, but yet social entrepreneurs were always struggling with getting their work started and scaling it. And I wanted to see why that wasn't working. And so still coming from this business background, I thought, well, you know, the solution is let's just get corporations to invest in social ideas. And where can I make a good case for a company to care about a social issue? For me, that ended up being, I chose the issue of HIV/AIDS. And I looked at South Africa as the place where probably the greatest problems existed for these companies. Some of them were hiring three workers in order to do one job because they knew two of them would die from AIDS by the end of the year. And their, you know, healthcare costs and recruitment costs were so high that if I could convince them, look at this social entrepreneur doing amazing work on HIV/AIDS. Why don't you invest in them? This could actually affect your bottom line. So I went to South Africa. I traveled all over the country visiting companies and social entrepreneurs, trying to really get my head around this issue and what I thought I could do about it. And one day, one of these change agents said, you know, have you taken the time yet to go speak with the women in the townships? And, you know, I said, no, I don't really quite even know how to go in there and find who to talk to. So he arranged for me to go and sit down with this young woman. Her name was Zuleka Natuli. She was at the time unemployed, wasn't formally educated, but you know, she sat down with me and her friend, Anna, who had full-blown AIDS, to talk to us about what is the human side of this disease, what does it look like, and what's happening. And she shared with me a number of very disturbing stories and information about the crisis in South Africa. One of the areas of greatest concern is sexual violence and its relationship to the spread of HIV. There's, in some cases, terrible myths that having sex with a virgin will cure you of AIDS. So men are raping infants to make sure that they can find a virgin. And there's just this sense that men are entitled to sex and that's women's duty. And when this began to manifest within children in her community, Zuleka had heard of a 12-year-old girl who was raped by her 12-year-old boyfriend and his friends because that's what they thought their right was, and they wanted to experiment with their right to sex. She'd had enough. She had to work on this issue. So she got some change together. She bought some bread. She invited 15 women together to start talking about this issue. And there's a lot of taboo around sexual violence as well. It's a difficult thing to talk about. And she did some bead work to put herself through, you know, sell some products to put herself through HIV/AIDS counseling. And she was really getting engaged in this issue when I met her. It was about 6 months after she started her work. And she had 45 people, including a third of them men, meeting 3 times a week, making major inroads in this community dialogue to address child sexual violence. And she was only 25 years old. And she knew exactly what was needed to start working to prevent women and others in her community from contracting HIV and ending sexual violence. But she didn't have any money. She didn't have any training. She was not computer literate. She couldn't go down to an internet cafe and look up a grant. And at that moment, it just hit me. Why am I spending my time in these big corporate boardrooms trying to make a case for their investing more money that they're not really even interested in doing? This here with Zuleka, this is where change is really happening. And there must be women just like her all over the planet who know exactly what they need to do to create change, but they've never had the opportunity or the skills and resources to do it. And I can take from my background in business and my network, perhaps I can provide some of these skills, training, and resources to support women like Zuleka in creating their own sustainable organizations. So that was 2004. That was my aha moment. In finally, I felt I'd found my niche, my purpose, where I could be of service.
And how old were you at that time?
I was 30.
30, okay.
So I decided to work with the most disadvantaged women where I could find social ideas. And my next step was going to the Darfur refugee camps of Eastern Chad as I was working on this film about Darfur. And I found ideas there too. I mean, these were women who had crossed the desert in fear of their lives, fleeing a genocide, illiterate farmers, now displaced population in a refugee camp, still suffering greatly, and yet they had ideas for change they were trying to advance within their own environment. I was so impressed, and so many of the other aid groups were focused on their narrow task of what they were doing to serve the population that they didn't have the capacity and possibly the interest in listening to what refugees themselves wanted. But working in a displaced population on foreign soil is very complicated, lots of red tape and UN umbrellas and things like that. So I eventually ended up in Rwanda, where I wanted to learn what the long-term impacts of genocide were on women and what needs they have to rebuild, and finally found our niche for global grassroots working post-conflict, where women, though they bear the greatest burden of war, they are also the ones tasked primarily with rebuilding. And that's where I felt we could be the most supportive. And these women were some of the most incredible change agents. And that's where we ended up starting our work.
Hmm. And did you find when you were traveling to these different areas and just really on the ground, were women emerging as natural leaders? Like, was that something you noticed happening on its own?
Yes, I think women, you know, in many cases, they have not had opportunities to be leaders. But when suddenly they make up the majority of the population as widows,
right,
they're having to rebuild caring for their children and others' orphans. They are having to take on jobs that they'd never had access to before and responsibilities for rebuilding community. But even still, at the nation building level, at the top, they're not always involved. So they're natural caretakers, and their style of leadership is different than what we may normally see and look at in terms of leaders emerging. They're working more at the grassroots level. They're working more in a caretaker capacity, but they're equally innovative and have deep wisdom and ideas about what they need and what they want to do.
And your organization sort of developed a really unique approach to empowering social change agents and developing programs. And I'd love to just have you share a little bit about how you talk in your work about this intersection of four spheres and how this creates a more holistic approach to social change and sustainability. Did you want to just share a little bit about the approach and maybe what you see as unique about this approach to really creating a longer term sustainability in post-conflict regions?
Sure. So our program is called the Academy for Conscious Change, and it's really an incubator for social ventures. And that's not businesses. We're focused on helping women create social purpose organizations. So they're driven by a mission to solve a social problem, not by profit. And they're working on whatever is of priority to them in their own communities. And that may be water access or girls' reproductive health or illiteracy or gender-based violence. We wanted to create this incubator because there were so few resources and opportunities that these women had to get their own ideas off the ground, just like Zuleka Natuli. But we incorporate a very holistic mix of personal and social transformation tools. Our program starts with a training, intensive training program. And what we're looking for teams of women who have ideas for change, but they may never have started on them yet. And we invite their representatives of their teams into the program. That begins with mind-body trauma healing. We're using meditation, breath, movement, and other mind-body or contemplative practice to support change agents in actually healing physiologically from the trauma that they have experienced from war or violence. And we're using a particularly unique breath practice that has been studied and refined by two doctors of clinical psychiatry, but they're based in ancient Eastern practices that they've studied throughout the world. And this pace of breathing actually helps the nervous system reset itself after a traumatic event so that it almost entirely eliminates the symptoms of post-traumatic stress when practiced over a period of time. We're teaching these skills because they're very easy to teach across different cultures and different languages. And most of the women that we're working with have had a traumatic and violent experience. And the symptoms of post-traumatic stress really inhibit their ability to move forward and become change leaders. Plus, women are so good at self-sacrifice that they're focused on their families and their communities, and they don't take the time normally to address their own healing needs. So we felt that like this was a really important process, if not for themselves, for the women they may also be working with to learn these skills that they can teach to others. So the first step is the mind-body trauma healing. The second step are what we call conscious leadership practices. And these involve very inner-driven, experiential, mindfulness-based practices that help our change agents understand from a personal perspective, what does change look like for themselves and for others? What are the unconscious ways in which we react and sometimes create harm and can become part of the problem? Working on how to take care of ourselves so we don't get burned out and disillusioned and angry, but can be more effective change leaders, and to ensure that we don't abuse our power or get so attached to our agenda that we miss out on being attuned to what communities really need, and so that we can lead for transformation. So that's our conscious leadership skills. And then the third component we teach is social entrepreneurship skills. And these are really all the nuts and bolts, all the tools you need to start a small nonprofit from scratch and build it into a self-sustaining organization. So we provide this training, and then our staff works with each of these groups like coaches, hands-on, to help them design their organization. Then we fund the organization's startup costs with a grant, and then we work with them another year in like a nonprofit management apprenticeship so that at the end of the program, they're self-sufficient. And so we look at ourselves as working at the intersection of four different spheres, and that includes the social entrepreneurship realm, which most of the global social entrepreneurship organizations are focused on supporting leaders that are at the point of changing, global policy. We're really focused on the earliest stage, most marginalized change agent that exists where they've had almost no access to the support and the tools they need.
I'm curious too, if in relation to that, like, do you find that really supporting those really marginalized community at the grassroots level creates more sustainable change within the community over perhaps policy imposed from the outside? Have you noticed, I mean, they're obviously both important, but have you noticed that one creates more effective change than the other?
I believe when you're working with grassroots change agents, you're going to see immediate shifts taking place where policy takes a long time. You know, in a place like Rwanda, where we work, Rwanda has some of the most progressive policies supporting women's rights and an incredible track record of women being able to move into positions of great power. They have more women members of parliament than any other country on the planet. Mm-hmm. But at the grassroots level, despite laws that protect women's rights, it's very difficult for women who aren't even educated about those rights to protect themselves or know what recourse to seek to protect themselves. So when working with grassroots change agents, they can immediately put into place very innovative and very cost-effective solutions that are culturally appropriate and they work mm-hmm. and can be sustained by their own communities. And so both are needed, but we just feel that the grassroots change agent has the least support, and that's where we want to provide our resources and energy. The second sphere that we're working in is the what's generally seen as the women's empowerment realm. And I have to say, I don't actually even like the word empowerment. We know that it's defined and it means something to people working in this sphere, but I feel like the word empowerment still suggests it's something that I'm doing to you, I'm empowering you. When the women we're working with are already powerful, it's just a process of recognizing the power that they have, especially that which comes from within as opposed to dominant culture, and being able to embrace and embody that to courageously advance their own ideas. And once these women have the experience of successfully creating change, they tend to go on to continue to do so. And it's amazing to see the leadership that they take on after this first successful experience. It's also critically important that this personal and social intersection for healing after war. And this brings me into another realm that we're working in international development, especially in post-conflict countries. When a woman has, especially during war, especially where sexual violence has been used as a tool of war, when she's been so violated by her community and her society that failed to protect her, in many cases, the women we start working with think they have nothing to offer. They have no value. When she recognizes she does have value and she has the capacity to change the society that failed her, that's extraordinarily not just empowering, but healing on an individual level and on a community level. And so we feel that this fusion of social entrepreneurship, trauma healing, and leadership is critical in the post-conflict development space. And we are so fiercely committed to doing our work on a participatory basis where we never impose our values. We never impose our solutions. We don't even impose what we think they should be working on. Everything is negotiated and designed, and we act exclusively as facilitators. Everything we do is run through our Rwandan Advisory Council to make sure that we're meeting local needs. We're measuring our impact based on local metrics so that we can, as much as possible, you know, be partners and not be outsiders coming in top down telling them what it is that they need to do. So that we think is much more powerful and aligned with a sort of inner driven paradigm for conscious change.
Yeah, and I think that harks back to what the bit we touched on around policy and then supporting, you know, grassroots leadership, because if I was reading some other cases where policies or laws were created, you know, just to protect women's rights, but if women in the community didn't actually feel they deserved them, or if somehow felt, you know, they felt disempowered within the community, they wouldn't actually take advantage of the laws. And when you actually support them to develop leadership and initiatives within their community, they're going to be a lot more strong and have a sense that they really deserve these rights. Whereas if you're just trying to impose from the outside, it's not going to have the same effect.
No, absolutely. I'd love to tell you a quick story about one of these change agents. We've been working for the longest with this one group called Hard Workers, that I think is one of the most extraordinary examples of what you were just describing of women's leadership and really being able to take hold of that potential. In this rural community of Gahanga on the outskirts of Kigali, there's, like many parts of Rwanda, there's no access to clean water, and women have to walk about 3 or 4 miles down a hill to a dirty creek and fill up their jugs of water with contaminated, you know, it's they're either hand dug wells or their streams are kind of flowing down the mountain past latrines and other waste, and to walk this water back up the hill again. And so, you know, for women, that basically eats up most of their day, so they can't do other things. They could send their girls to do it, but then their girls wouldn't go to school. They could go early before dawn and try and get to the water holes first, but then that means they're more susceptible to opportunistic sexual violence when they're traveling alone in the dark. If it takes them too long, it can also be a trigger for domestic violence when they get home. And for those who are pregnant, elderly, disabled, blind, or too sick to make that journey, it's almost impossible. They can pay a man to deliver it for them, but many of these women can't afford to pay. And one woman told us when we were talking to this community about the issues of greatest importance to them, she said, you know, your kids are coming home from school, you need this water to cook rice and beans, you've got to do what you got to do. So within this community, many of these vulnerable women were being forced to trade sex to get their water delivered every day. And so this young woman, Seraphine Hasimana, and her group of 19 women decided that sexual exploitation of women for water was their issue of priority that they wanted to create a social venture around. So they went through our training program, and we gave them a small startup grant of $2,600. And they built a water venture right in the middle of their village, so women didn't have to walk anywhere. Was involved 2 big tanks attached to a church gutter that would collect rainwater that they could purify during the rainy season, and they would just pay for a truck to deliver water during the dry season, and they'd sell it to those who could afford to pay, and then they could make sure they could always give away the water for free to the vulnerable women. So they started this project serving 100 households. And women, they're so dedicated to this work. Some of them are as old as 75, and they sleep side by side in shifts each night by their tanks to protect their water from being stolen. And over time, the project began to become so valuable to this community that men started asking to join the project. And then when women couldn't make their shifts at night, the husbands would sometimes do it the shift for them. So we started early on seeing gender relations begin to shift in the community. The women then made enough money from selling water that they could buy women's health insurance for them and pay for orphan school fees. And then they started a revolving credit fund where they would let a woman borrow $50 each month, whoever needed it the most, and then when she could pay it back, they'd lend it out to somebody else, which spun off several other community ventures, like a community garden and a brick making company. And then they started having women walking from 3 hours away to come see, you know, how did they do this? And they had an avenue to start teaching the skills that they'd learned. Then a local official asked Seraphine to speak on radio about water issues. And then later she was invited to Kenya to start talking about issues of her first trip out of the country. And we are 5 years into their venture. It's completely sustainable. Last year they expanded to 3 new sites. They're serving 6,000 people with water access. They are committed to keep going as much as they can. The minute they can expand again, they're going to keep expanding to serve more and more vulnerable women. And this group is made up of, most of them are widows. They are, majority of them, subsistence farmers. They were living on like $2 a day. They don't even want to pay themselves because they believe that this is a nonprofit project for the community. And those 19 people, only 7 of them actually know how to read. They are largely ignorant. But this is what I'm talking about that is so unrecognized by most groups, that there's local wisdom, there's local initiative, and when women have the chance to take that first step into becoming change leaders, they don't stop.
Yeah. Well, that's what's really powerful. I mean, I read about that story as well, and I found it really powerful because, you know, you can start with giving something that actually seems quite small, and they can take that and turn it into something that just grows and grows, you know. So working at that grassroots level really allows for that evolution to happen on its own, which is really beautiful.
Exactly.
Is there any other kind of, we've talked a little bit about the pitfalls of some of traditional aid programs. I'm curious if you could just share a little bit about what you see as the traditional way that aid is delivered in regions like Africa or other places, and maybe the edge that you think is really important for us. I mean, we've been talking about this, but the edge that's really important as we engage more as a global society and want to start supporting people all over the world with developing in their own countries. What do you think are the most important edges to be paying attention to?
Well, I think some of the pitfalls I've seen, there's a difference between humanitarian aid and international development. Obviously, during a conflict and post-disaster, there's a great need for the world to step in and provide immediately the resources to meet people's basic needs. That's, mm-hmm. you know, we all agree on that. But there is this question of how do you transition from that to self-sufficiency and how soon can you do that? And I think a lot of aid agencies, you know, without a solid sort of exit and transition strategy can end up creating dependency, which is what we're seeing in places like Haiti now, which sometimes is called like the Republic of NGOs. There's so many organizations that were there before the earthquakes are since there, and there's become this dependency on aid. You know, even Rwanda, when I started working in Rwanda, it was, you know, our first program was about 12 years after the genocide ended. And we were told that, well, the people who will come to your program, they're going to want you to pay them their transportation to get there. They want you to provide a meal, and they will probably ask you to provide income replacement, because if they're not working to come to your program, they want to be paid for the time that they lost working. And I was thinking, whoa, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand that there are economic barriers to participation, but there's this like expectation now that if you're going to do an NGO program, all these things are going to be provided. So we had to work against that immediately to set a precedent that we're about supporting self-sufficiency through tools and coaching and facilitation and partnership, not just handouts. And what does this look like? Well, I'll tell you another quick story. And I think this is where international programs can really look at very closely, one, what is the underlying wisdom, insight, and needs of the community, and how can you be a facilitator of local initiative and local leadership? Like, that's the absolutely most critical. And people say, oh, we've consulted locally, but that's not the same thing as supporting local initiatives and local leadership and local solutions. And then, you know, secondly, how can we be supportive in terms of skills? And, you know, I think catalytic resources that get you started, but with the assumption and the intentionality and the time put into the design of this work that leads to self-sufficiency and sustainability. So one of the things that we teach are creative strategies for supporting your venture in your own community, so you're not dependent on foreign aid once you get started. And one of those principles we teach is about looking around and leveraging waste. Like, what's being wasted? How can you use that to support your work? By, are they raw materials? Can you sell it? Can you trade it? Like, how do you use waste to support you? So one of our ventures is a literacy program called Invincible Vision 2020. And they were teaching 1,300 women how to read. And they were working at night out of primary schools where kids would go in the daytime. So they had donated space. And we provided their initial startup expenses for all their materials. But they didn't have a way of paying their teachers' salaries. Now, these women going to the literacy program were too poor to pay a school fee. And they didn't want that to be a barrier. So they had to come up with another way of paying those teacher salaries. So they looked around and wanted to see what was being wasted in this rural village. And what they decided were their assets that were being wasted were rocks, sticks, and broken bricks. Now, I don't know about you. If somebody said to me, what's being wasted? And I looked around, I probably would look right past the rocks. But that these were assets they could use. So what did they do? They tell the women, we know you can't pay a school fee for your program, but instead, we want you to bring a rock or a brick or a stick with you when you come to class and just stick it in a pile. And if your kids are coming to these schools during the day, have them do the same thing. Well, after a couple of weeks, they had such a huge pile of rocks, sticks, and bricks that they filled a dump truck with the rocks and bricks and sold it to a construction company as building supplies. And they bundled all the sticks and they sold them locally as firewood, and they made enough money to pay their teachers' salaries for several weeks. This is the start to their sustainability strategies, and they had such excitement over that success that they continued with innovations around ways to work locally to do this, to sustain their work. And that's where I think self-sufficiency is supported. Local communities begin to support and have buy-in to these organizations in their own communities. You're working against dependency internationally, and creativity is unleashed.
Yeah. And what I love about your organization, too, is that you really also follow and track, you know, as people, as they move on with the business, you follow and measure, like, is this sustainable? Stay with them with the support if they need it, but you really let them take it off in their own way. So I think that's a really neat service that you're offering as well through your organization.
We do, and we're very much a learning organization. We, you know, in our efforts not to impose, we want to understand how we're best meeting local needs. And we're also curious about this, what is transformation and how do you measure it? So we might say, you know, we'd love to see a shift happen in the difficulty of our change agents' lives, and that we ask them, you know, how would you define that? So we have locally defined measures of well-being, and sometimes it's economic and sometimes it's not. And what's been so fascinating over time as we've evaluated our work is that in some cases, our change agents' economic situations aren't changing at all. They're the same as they were when they started their venture. Mm-hmm. But because of this integration of personal transformation work, as well as what comes of the success of being change agents, we will see our questions asking them about the difficulty of their life, like how difficult is it and how powerful do you feel? Those indicators shift dramatically. They feel more powerful. They feel their lives are not as difficult, even if like the concrete measures sometimes haven't shifted significantly. So we know this fusion of inner and outer is so important.
And your organization has trained, I think, over 300 emerging change agents, and you've launched 21 civil society organizations, and there's lots of other social ventures in development. And I know you're sort of expanding now, and other women in other countries and women's groups there's more demand for your program and the unique approach that you're bringing. I'm curious just to hear a little bit as we sort of tie it all together, just what you're hoping Global Grassroots will emerge into in the future and how you're wanting to support women all over the world with these kind of programs.
Thank you. You know, our long-term vision is that change agents anywhere on the planet, especially the most vulnerable women, if they have an idea for social change, they'll know where to go to get the resources and the training to initiate it. And we're moving in 5 different directions to reach that vision. And I just want to step back really quick and say, you know, we're not necessarily a women's rights organization. We are actually committed to creating a conscious society. But if half the population is so underserved and yet they have such great vision that we feel women can be such an incredible lever for change. That's why we're investing there. But we also have men participate in our programs. So we're not exclusively focused on just women. We want to work together with the most marginalized to reach a more compassionate, conscious society. So how do we do that? Right now, we're growing in five ways. Mm-hmm. We're growing geographically. We have had our program in Rwanda for 6 years. And this year, we're expanding into northern Uganda to work with former sex slaves of the Lord's Resistance Army. And we'll be setting up a whole new program there like we have in Rwanda. And hopefully, our Rwanda and Ugandan change agents will be able to have opportunities for exchange. But we also have had women in over 45 countries ask for our programs. So we decided what would happen if we just gave them the curriculum. And that led us to create a technology platform that we're calling our E-Academy for Conscious Change. And this will have all of the same curriculum in conscious leadership and social entrepreneurship that we do hands-on, but it will be interactive. So that as change agents go through the program, they're gradually, with their homework, creating a venture plan for their idea, and we will be able to have access to what change agents are working on all over the world so we can learn from them. So that, I hope, it's being piloted in 10 countries right now, and I hope it will be launched at the beginning of next year. Our third area of expansion is to new audiences. You know, we've had a lot of interest from university students in what we're doing, and we've also seen so many of these young people with great intentions try to create change organizations that aren't sustainable and aren't aligned with what people need. So we're creating a university program that will offer the same curriculum to young change agents in this country, and we hope we'll be able to expand that over time as well to foster more compassionate and responsible social change.
And those are in traditional universities like in the US or?
Yes, right now our very first program is being piloted at Dartmouth College this fall. And then we hope to gradually expand it from there. And then our fourth area of expansion is around a particular issue of water. As I was describing with hard workers, the multiple dimensions of issues related to water and women. And we are part of a program now that's called the Global Water Challenges Women for Water Campaign that's trying to raise funding for women-led water ventures globally. And then finally, our final approach is to train others in our work. And we have a practitioner program for conscious social change practitioners, for anyone who wants to learn the mindfulness side and the social entrepreneurship side of our training program. We're training new practitioners, so, and hopefully with this core of practitioners, we'll be able to send them out on assignment to different parts of the world to work with new communities of change agents.
And that information is accessible on your website, the Global Grassroots website?
Not yet, because it's just in the earliest stages. Gotcha. But anyone who is interested can email us through our website, and we will provide more information about that to any interested group.
Perfect. Well, it's fabulous. I love what you're doing, and I'd love to just stay in contact and keep the conversation going, because I'm just really attracted to the work you're doing, and I'm glad it's getting out there. So thank you so much for being a guest. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Vanessa. It's been such a pleasure and an honor.